This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 104th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today Rick Gordon, who's sitting right in front of me at the studio. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Rick Gordon is a managing partner at the cybersecurity incubator Mach 37. Rick has held a number of positions in high-tech businesses, including VP of Product Management at Q Corp. Is that right? Is that how you say it?
K-E-Y-W.
K-E-Y-W Corp. COO of Looking Glass, Managing Director of Civitas Group, and CEO of Tavares. Rick served in the Navy as a submariner and also put in some time on Wall Street at Bear Stearns. Rick has an MBA at the UVA from the UVA Darden School of Business and a BS from the Naval Academy. He lives in Maryland with four kids and a registered nurse who's his spouse. Rick is in the Willie Walters Wrestling Hall of Fame and was a D1 wrestler in the U.S. Navy, which he just really never told me about.
I had no idea I was in the Hall of Fame. That's going to go on the top of my epitaph.
You didn't know that?
No, but I'm proud of it already.
My people found out. So let's start with the Navy. What did your service in the Navy teach you about security?
It's a really great question, oddly, no one's ever asked that, Gary. But if I had to start with it, it would be attention to detail. Certainly, when I started my career, either as a midshipman or as an ensign in the submarine force, you know, it was serious work. We were operating nuclear reactors, and I think that there was a tremendous appreciation for attention to detail. In that business, if you make mistakes, bad things happen.
Right.
And I think similarly, in our industry, attention to detail, certainly matters. And we've seen that over and over and over again. It's, I think propensity of individuals to turn off alerts, based on, false alarm rates, in order to, avoid maybe some additional work is you can become problematic. Now, there are plenty of ways to engineer solutions around that, but at the end of the day, it comes down to sort of paying attention to the things you need to be paying attention to.
Yeah, so the devil's in the details. I completely agree with that. We've interviewed Richard Danzig, who was once the Secretary of the Navy, on Silver Bullet. So what was your rank? Were you also the secretary?
I was chief cook. When I got out, I was a lieutenant, which would have been the equivalent of a captain in the Army, but in 03.
How many ranks below Secretary of the Navy is that?
Too many to count. It's easier to count from the bottom. And, I think from scum of the earth, maybe two levels up.
You spent some time on Wall Street at an investment bank.
I did.
What evidence did you see there of information security in your very early career?
Very little. It's a funny question. I'll even admit it. So my excuse is that when I was on Wall Street, it was before I really made my first step into the information security community. But around that time was the Anna Kournikova virus, which I'm proud to say was my first lesson in cybersecurity.
Did you click on that?
I clicked. I was fresh out of the Navy. What do you expect?
You thought Anna Kournikova was in love with you?
Of course she was.
Okay. Wall Street's actually helped lead the charge in software security, according to my perspective. Do you think that other verticals are going to follow Wall Street's lead into thinking about security engineering and how to build security in?
So I think they're by definition going to follow. How quickly they're going to follow is probably the harder question to answer. I agree with you though. Wall Street is certainly leading and has led over for the last decade. The adoption of leading edge technologies and I think more advanced solutions. And we certainly saw or are starting to see this sort of evolution. From reactive response to being more strategic or perhaps being more analytical from a threat intelligence perspective from that sector, perhaps more than any other. save maybe the intelligence community here. So I think they are certainly leading in that regard, and probably will, because it makes economic sense for them. You know, I haven't seen a CEO from any other sector come out publicly saying we're going to double our budget, which is already a massive by comparison budget in the commercial sector. I'm speaking specifically about JPMorgan Chase.
Yeah, I'd like to see that budget applied to security engineering as much as to what you might call reactive security or clean up on aisle 7 security. I think that we have to do those other kinds of security, by the way. We got to have our firewalls, we've got to have our forensics, but we also really just need to build stuff to be secure in the first place. And I think Wall Street has actually been doing a fairly decent job with that. I hope they don't quit.
No, I agree with that. And it's you, of course, are an expert in building security and we're starting to, see that, what we've seen it pick up traction over the last several years, thankfully. When I was an analyst in this space, perhaps a decade ago, I was more optimistic software security or building security from the beginning would pick up traction a little more quickly. Mm-hmm. But now that I'm investing in this space, perhaps it's a better opportunity for me. At Mach 37 made two specific investments that are technologies that enable developers to build security in more quickly.
Yeah, I think we're probably accounting for 10% of the computer security market in software security right now, which means it's probably a $7 to $8 billion industry and growing at twice the rate that computer security is in general. So we're making progress, but you're right, we got a long way to go.
Sounds like a good market to invest in to me.
So I met you a long time ago when you were the very young and very earnest CEO of Tavares in Charlottesville, Virginia. What's the most interesting and surprising thing that you learned as a newbie CEO?
So what I learned very quickly is, I certainly didn't know it all. But as I, even years after that experience as a startup CEO, what I think discovered is that my instincts were pretty good. In that market, at that time in the security market, it certainly wasn't the market that we have today.
Yeah,
it was hard.
It was a long time ago.
It was a much more challenging market back then. We learned to execute well. You'll appreciate this. At that time, I was smart enough to hire, disciplined developers that were able to put, a rigorous process in place, that was agile before agile was even, a term that people were throwing around.
I remember the cards on the wall, and I also remember moving some of them around just to see what would happen.
That's right. You probably added a ton of value by doing that.
I was bringing in the Krispy Kreme donuts to keep them occupied while we moved the cards around.
Right. But I did learn a lot from that experience early. One is that timing matters in a market, and uh-huh. even in that Tavares in particular, if it were being built today, now's the right time for what they were doing. They were focused on encryption technology, and I recall at the time, wishing that we could prove that the man in the middle really did exist. And as most of us know from within the last couple of years, we've demonstrated that the man in the middle does exist, and he exists in many places.
Well, there are lots of men in the middle, or humans in the middle, as the case may be.
That's right. Which is a big reason that encryption technology is resurging again in ways to either build it in when applications are first conceived. Is happening. It's not just an afterthought now.
So both of us are based near Washington, D.C., but practicing primarily commercial information security. What kinds of influence Positive and negative, does Washington have on InfoSec?
I'll give you one of each. Let me start with the positive one. As I look over the last decade, when information security really started to surge, I think Washington did catalyze a lot of the growth. It was hard to make a really good living in the information security industry, early in the last decade. As 2008 rolled around and the Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative started taking hold and growing, there was not only a significant financial catalyst that was going into security innovation with activities that were, within the intelligence community primarily, but even, beyond that. There was also this, recognition that we had a problem. We had a big problem, and it wasn't just a commercial enterprise problem. It was a national security problem that crossed over into our economic security. And so that I think catalyzed a lot of the current market that we're in. I think it took the commercial side of the now the cybersecurity market maybe a couple more years to catch up to this sort of step increase in federal spending, but we're also starting to see that as well. So I think that raising awareness about the problem, increasing investment did a lot for the industry.
Okay, that's a good positive thing.
Negative?
What kind of negative impact has Washington's view of computer security had?
So the prejudice toward compliance over actual real risk mitigating action, I think, is the unintended consequence of what you're seeing from in this case or SP 153 or the FISMA. Regs. I think we have, in the commercial sector, we have the ISO 27000 analog. But if you talk to CISOs throughout the industry about how they budget and how they spend their money, quite often when I do that, the response that I get is, well, they're the things that we have to buy, and then once if there's any money left over, then we start to invest in the things that we want to buy, and of course it begs the question, what are the things that you have to buy? And invariably it comes down to those things that they have to buy in order to be compliant with regulations, and quite often there's not a significant security benefit that would warrant the cost when there may be other approaches that they could have a bigger reduction in risk.
So, let's think about your classic policy wonk in Washington. What do you think they know about cybersecurity? What do they think about? Do they think about it?
So it's funny. I spent 7 years as a strategy consultant at the nexus between the policy environment and the commercial environment, and while I was more prejudiced toward the commercial side, you get exposed to it. They understand security policy, and I think that they perhaps understand well, at least they all have a view of what the role of government is in catalyzing and improved security or information security, at least across the United States. So I think that they're very, typically very thoughtful about that. I think that many of them lack, two things. One, many of them lack a depth of understanding of what the technology really entails. And, if there is, there are no silver bullets. I know you appreciate that.
There is one, and you're on it.
That's right. So I think that... we've seen it with some unfortunate quotes by senior cybersecurity policymakers. I think a lack of recognition that technical depth does matter. It isn't, it's certainly not anything to be dismissive of. And the most unfortunate thing about that recent comment was it. I think it was dismissive.
Which comment are you talking about?
I'm talking about the comment by the cyber czar, basically saying it was and I'm going to paraphrase probably incorrectly, but it was an advantage that he technically astute. And, you know,
I'm not technical, so that's good.
And that's just, that's you know, maybe it's wishful thinking. At best, it's wishful thinking. Worse, it's just silliness. But it's not true. And, you know, asked that question at the beginning, what I learned in the Navy, that certainly was another lesson learned is, you know, your technical acumen does matter.
Yep.
You know, I would not consider myself a technologist, and I consider that a handicap in this industry. And I think any of the policymakers that don't understand the technology should also consider that it's a handicap and do what they can to ameliorate that weakness.
I think that's a good way of putting it. It's kind of about being able to communicate between two groups of people that don't really speak the same language. So you have to be a translator between technical reality and policy reality, which to many of us technical people is pretty much incomprehensible.
Absolutely right. And I think akin to that, Gary, the I think a second phenomenon that you see is sort of a lack of appreciation of what it's like to be in a commercial enterprise. Hmm. Try to deal with this, the risk from threats from all over the world that are well funded, better funded in the aggregate than their targets, and the asymmetry of the job that they face, and getting one more control that they have to put on their compliance checklist without any understanding of what the positive impact or risk is just not helpful.
Hmm. So I'm wondering if you think that Washington understands security engineering at all. When I poke my head over there, it seems like they pretty much don't, with the exception of maybe DARPA, who's beginning to try to build some stuff that's hardened.
So I think there are pockets of it. DARPA, there are, I think, certain folks within on the Homeland Security side that may sort of understand, risk management in security engineering. But I will say, I've experienced this in the past that, when so I'm a big believer in risk management but I think that there is a certain amount of accountability associated with, making, resource allocation decisions, based on risk, which forces you, whether you're doing it, consciously or not. You're making a determination of what you think the probability of an event happening is in order to determine how much you should spend to ameliorate the impact.
I think that, there's nothing wrong with risk management, but I do worry when I look at, say, the entire application portfolio of a multinational bank, that there may be such a low risk associated with some of the applications that absolutely nothing gets done. So in some sense, you have your minimum line and the risk threshold drops below that minimum line. So nothing happens for the really low stuff. And that's bad. And so though we're doing a great job with the high risk stuff, I believe we need to do something more than nothing for the low risk stuff.
So I agree with you to a degree. I do think that... if you look at the low risk stuff and putting a lot of thought into the consequences of losing that information or losing control of that asset inside your network, could have larger consequences.
Well, I think about it less in terms of assets and more in terms of handholds and toeholds for a real attack.
Right.
Like if you think about what happened with that major retailer where it was the HVAC vendor that actually brought them down because their IT was so weak that the HVAC vendor hack worked. That's a pretty low risk, really. If you have a reasonable architecture, your HVAC vendor can't bring you down.
That's right. So that is an example of sort of something you would not think could have a significant impact to you. Yeah, I guess if you want to be academically rigorous about it, a good risk management approach could actually, you know, address that.
I think you just say the floor has to be, at a reasonable level. So right. So we'll manage risk in an expensive way for the high risk stuff, and we're good at that. But the floor has to be higher.
Right. So I think the problem that we see, you know, particularly we saw a lot in the government in sort of this last decade around homeland security in risk was this sort of aversion toward even doing risk management. What we would do was consequence management and then just sort of, you know, invest heavily in those things that had dramatic impact, even though the probability of the event occurring was really, really low.
I see. But that's one way to calculate risk. You just do impact times probability.
And
the
one.
Impact was so big, you just say, well, that's a big risk.
That is right. And but in that case, that kind of thinking actually creates an environment that describes what you just described with you know, with Target itself.
Right.
It's
right.
These smaller risk things that may have a, you know, reasonably high P event, a probability of the event occurring.
Right.
That you know, you just can't ignore. And I do think that they're within the government security infrastructure, there are lots of managers, because they have imperfect data, aren't willing to manage that way, because it forces them to basically state what they think.
Right, right. So that's enough with the government. My okay. government threshold has been exceeded. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. Tell us about the concept behind Mach 37.
So I wish I could say it was my idea. It wasn't. It was, I think, the idea of Pete Jobsey, who is the head of the Center for Innovative Technology. Pete, as you may know, was one of the original founding team members of ArcSight. So he certainly gets cybersecurity and you know, the disruptive nature of it. Or ways in that you can build good product companies to disrupt the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
What Pete saw in this region in particular, the Mid-Atlantic region, was a tremendous amount of intellectual capital sort of walking the streets. These were a lot of either analysts or technologists that were solving really difficult problems within the intelligence community, within DOD, some in the federal civilian side, and then is similarly, you know, companies like Mandiant that had grown, you know, significantly over, let's say, the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
But they were, so they were, there was this wealth of understanding, particularly around the threat and how it gets into your network, how it obfuscates itself, where the artifacts of a compromise might be, how to aggregate them, then, you know, raise the signal to noise ratio up enough that you could actually detect them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an abundance here, more so than anywhere in the world. What perhaps is lacking in this region compared to, let's say, you know, Palo Alto, was this understanding of how to take that, those concepts, those ideas that are disruptive, and commercialize them in product companies that are disruptive. You know, instead of solving problems for one or two customers, solving them for one or 2,000. Pete's hypothesis was, if we could create this accelerator and harness this critical mass of intellectual capital, and then supplement it with those other things that may be less abundant here, but we could either train entrepreneurs or find them individuals with those skill sets, or find consultants to help them get their companies established, then we could create an ecosystem here that would rival anywhere.
Right.
At least for security.
So that's a hell of an elevator pitch. You have to have a really tall building for that elevator pitch.
Sorry.
So tell me in 7 words what Mach 37 does for people who haven't heard from you. Although everything that you said makes perfect sense, but knowing what Mach 37 is in the first place is something that many listeners may not.
So Mach 37's an early stage investor that launches disruptive cybersecurity product companies.
Got it. So you're looking around for startup ideas that need some help with management, with tech, with productization, with everything?
So it'd be great if I could find teams that didn't need anything that still wanted to let me make an investment in them. Those mm-hmm. don't exist. Mm-hmm. What we do is we look for disruptive cybersecurity ideas or entrepreneurs that have ideas to make usually the first investment in those companies. We're prejudiced toward technologists that have solved a really difficult challenge. For a very large problem and where there's an opportunity for us to add tremendous value by bringing those other skill sets to their company in a way that no one else can.
So what's with the name?
So Mach 37 is escape velocity, if you remember back to your physics class.
Oh, man, I don't remember back. I always wondered what was up with your name.
So I have to confess, I had to look it up, too. Although I remember the class. I definitely had that class.
Gosh, I can't. So that's escape velocity for 1G on planet Earth.
That's exactly right.
Wow, who knew?
Now you do.
I'm not geeky enough
anymore. Oh, we were thinking about a separate company calling it Mach 38, but, you know, maybe that's such a good idea.
So it's Mach 37 plus Epsilon, hopefully.
There you go.
So how many cohorts have you run, and tell us about that, kind of the way that you structure the classes of companies.
So we've run 3 so far. We're sized right now to run 2 a year. There are 4 partners that really run the day-to-day of the operation. We call them cohorts. The first cohort was in the fall of 2013. That was 4 companies. In the spring of 14, we did 6. We did 7. We're currently finishing up the fall 2014 cohort with 7 companies. Funny story. We think 6 is our normal number, and we mm-hmm. were ready to take 6. And we had one that came in that we really fell in love with and weren't going to say no to. Mm-hmm. So we just we do what good entrepreneurs do. We refactored. We refactored.
Major number prime. 17 is good. So 17 cohorts all told. 17 companies.
17 companies total. Really proud of all of them.
How many Mach 37 companies have been funded past the incubator stage?
So about half so far. Uh-huh. All 17 are still viable.
Right.
Some of them are obviously moving faster than others, and it is what you would imagine a portfolio to look like. Some of them have a little further to go, and if you, Gary, you've built companies before. Sometimes success is predicated more on being around long enough to find luck.
What are you saying? 20 years of slogging against software security is not great. So what's your expected outcome over time, as you watch these things grow and thrive? What are you looking for?
So we're looking, big picture, as we're looking to create an ecosystem here that's self-sustaining, that let's say after we do this for, 4 or 5 years, and have created the next generation of security startups, that there will be enough of a critical mass here that you start to see this ecosystem become, take on a life of its own. Mm-hmm. We don't have to continue to push it. So that's big picture. From a cohort-to-cohort basis, we expect more than half of each cohort to get seeded. If we do our job right, a large majority of those that get seeded will get through their A rounds. We believe that our stewardship, if you will, of the companies, the mentoring that we continue to do for all of them, not just the ones in session, will start to wane as they get their Series A rounds from institutional VCs.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like passing the baton.
It is. And we think we fill a very critical gap in the evolution of innovative companies. But my hope is, at least I hope we get them in the hands of strong institutional VCs that can, you know, shepherd them along the way as well.
So is there an analog of Mach 37 out west among the, you know, Sand Hill Road types?
There are other kinds of accelerators.
The Y Combinator guys.
Y Combinator, right? Techstars. If you had to ask me programmatically what we're most like, probably a little like Techstars. Mm-hmm. Although I will tell you, we're not. It's not a numbers game for us. We're making investments in these companies, and it's not like, you know, if there's a weak one, I'm going to cast it aside.
That's because you just got started.
Well, maybe that's it. No, I really don't think that's it.
After you see 250, you might have a different...
Well, I mean, so there's some notion that if, you know, we picked a vertical that we really know well.
Right, right.
I honestly don't know how you could be a really effective accelerator unless your vertical lies to begin with, because no small team has the breadth of relationships that I think are required to help companies in the way that they need it at you know, the very early stages. So, mm-hmm. There's some notion that we could, you know, grow geographically. I don't think deal flow globally will support, you know, that many accelerators in any single vertical.
Mm-hmm.
We could expand beyond and go into other verticals, which is, you know, something we may think about later. I do think that the process that we build and the curriculum that we build is world-class. And can be applied in different geographies to different verticals if the other ingredients are there.
You should just go meta and become an incubator.
No, thank you. That would definitely take all the fun out of it.
I think that's what Y Combinator is trying to refer to.
No, oh, that's funny. So I don't know that I coined this term, but there is a term that I use called startupdom, which really describes the ecosystem around startup communities.
Mm-hmm.
We're not about that at all. I may be the least hip early stage investor you've ever met, aside from my partners. Look, we're serious. You know, I'm going to say this a little tongue in cheek. We're serious dudes,
right.
And we're doing serious work. And while there's a whole lot of fun going on, we really do think about how to make each of our entrepreneurs successful. They committed 3 months of their lives to us. They gave us a significant chunk of their business, and we owe it to them to make sure that they're successful.
Right.
And we don't take that lightly.
Right. So you've done a lot of stuff. You know, you lived on a submarine. You lived on Wall Street. You hung around with the policy wieners. You were a business guy. You're doing startup stuff now. Are you doing exactly what you want to do? Is it your favorite thing so far?
So this is definitely one of my favorite things so far. I would have to say it rivals my first startup, which financially was not a huge success for me at all, but it was absolutely the most fun I've ever had.
Cool.
Building something. And, you know, to a certain degree, we're building this accelerator, and it's a ton of fun.
So a completely out of left field question. Are you teaching your kids to wrestle?
So I am teaching my son to wrestle, and if you allow me to brag, he's very proud of him. I'll just say that he's a nationally ranked 11-year-old.
Wow! Does your wife know how to treat cauliflower ear?
Without a doubt.
Cool. Well, thanks for your time, Rick. It's been really interesting.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October 2014 issue of IEEE S&P focuses on CSERTs and incident response. The issue also features our conversation with Bart Miller about open source, Heartbleed, fuzz, and analysis tools. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.